Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. This week's episode, The Rise of the Far Right, What is at Stake for the West, discusses how far-right movements are gaining ground, not just at the margins, but in the mainstream. From fiery rhetoric to policy influence, they're reshaping the way we talk about identity, belonging, and power. What's fueling this rise, and why now? Recorded live at the 2025 Festival, this episode considers how this movement affects the future of democracy, free speech, and how can we respond.
Welcome, everybody, to, I don't know, Nabila's menopause session, because literally I am melting up here. So I will melt over here, and I will direct most of your attention to our esteemed panel. Mikad sends his regrets and is not here, but is very ably, and we are very thankful, to Dr. Hisham Helia, sitting in the middle. And then to my immediate right is my good friend Hafiz Ahmed, and I think everyone in Bradford knows who Naz Shah is. The format, I'm going to just throw out a couple of questions to each of them, and then I'd like to leave about 20 minutes or so for the audience participation, so that really you don't want to hear from me. I think they would much rather hear from you, and you would much rather hear from them. So hopefully that sets the stage. Really, what we're looking at right now, I think, was very nicely defined in Nafisa's recent book, and I'm going to give it a short plug. It's available at Waterstones, and I think he's available for a book signing afterwards. So he describes the time that we're in as quite possibly the most significant existential crisis in liberal democracy, and essentially says that we have lost our moral high ground when it comes to liberal democracy states. So Nafis, perhaps briefly, if you can define your thesis from the book, and then I'll direct questions to others as well around that thesis.
Sure. Okay. Thanks, Nabila, for that really kind introduction, and thanks everyone for coming along. I'm really excited to be here with Hisham, with Naz, good friends. So the book, Alt-Right, The Network World, Network War to Destroy the West from Within, that's the full subtitle. The book came out at the end of last year. We actually did an updated revised edition in February to make it very post-Trump. So very, very up to date. And I wrote the book in a year, but the book was actually based on 15 years of investigations that I've been doing into the far right. And I put it together because I realized that one of the big things that's missing at the moment from understanding of this threat is, first of all, how interconnected these groups are as a network, and not just kind of interconnected in a piecemeal way, but interconnected in very deep, insidious ways. The second thing that I think struck me more and more putting it together, because it's one thing to do stuff over 15 years. It's another thing when in a year you're looking at all of it and piecing things together, you're thinking, wow, what's going on? And the conclusion I came to is that these groups are hell-bent on infiltrating our democracies and turning them into something quite different. So the book tells this story as to how we got to this place where we have multiple far-right groups and political parties, movements, not only on the cusp of power in different Western democracies, but actually taking power. And obviously what happened with Trump's return to power in the United States kind of exemplifies that. How did we get here? How did we get to a point where, you know, the president of the United States can openly talk about the end of democracy, openly talk about in the run-up to the elections, to say that he would actually cancel elections and you don't need to vote anymore, and openly, brazenly say this? How did we get to this point? So the book actually tries to answer this question by going back in time where a lot of these groups started. So the story actually starts 100 years ago with 1930s traditional fascism. And it traces that story of how this ideology kind of metamorphosed after the collapse of the Nazis. And there was a need for white supremacist, openly Nazi groups to kind of tactically shift and reframe, because after the end of the Second World War, it wasn't fashionable anymore, of course, to go around being a card-carrying Nazi. The Nazis were just comprehensively defeated by the West. So they went underground. And when they went underground, they attempted to conceal their anti-Semitism under the guise of anti-black activism and especially anti-communist activism. And that continued to change. And what's been really interesting about these groups is how readily they're able to shapeshift in different political contexts, in different countries, in different circumstances. And I don't want to say, I want to be very clear about this actually, not everyone on the far right is a Nazi, and not everyone on the right wing is a Nazi, it goes without saying. There are many, many people on the right who would consider themselves to be anti-Nazi. And there are many people on the right who are good people. What my story really does is explore how very dangerous ideologies connected to Nazi ideology have moved into that space, into the space of the right and the center right, under the guise of freedom, liberty, democracy, but actually have a very, very different agenda. So many people in these movements don't actually realize what these people are about, what their ideology is. And I think I've gone on quite a bit, and we can kind of tease stuff out as we go along.
As we go along. Yeah. I was actually going to go next to Nas. In the context of what Nafees has spoken to, can you talk a little about what role populist elected leaders play in this? And, you know, we can view it as in the context of a crumbling democracy. What faith should we as an electorate keep in elections, and what constitutes electability?
That's a long question.
It is. I can break it down. I can break it down to three questions if you'd like.
Now, first of all, it's great to be here at the Bradford Literature Festival. I'm always happy to be in Bradford, in my constituency, but for Bradford Literature Festival and City of Culture, hope you're all enjoying it. Really, really important. In terms of a book, I'm just going to go back to the actual question. What is at stake for the West?
Yeah.
And it is literally
democracy.
Our democracy is at stake. If we look at post-Brexit, if we look at Nigel Farage now, I mean, for me, person, you know, you're sitting in a constituency which is 60% Muslim, and in the last few weeks in Parliament, it was relentless. We had the burqa comment by a woman who has less than 50 Muslims in her constituency, and I think less than 20 Muslim women over the age of 18 that could potentially wear a burqa. But she used her first Prime Minister's question to talk about banning the burqa. Then we had the halal meat debate by Rupert Lowe talking about the stunning of animals. It wasn't about the welfare of animals, it was about Muslims. And then we had the 10-minute rule bill by Nick Timothy talking about, you know, somebody who was arrested and he was done for, he got convicted for he didn't get convicted for burning the Quran, he got convicted under a public order offence, which was very different. Yet there was a 10-minute rule bill in Parliament that same week. And then we had the grooming gangs report. And it is relentless. Because I can tell you, here in Bradford West, right here, I remember in 2013, before I even thought about being in politics, Together Against Grooming was set up. We did the first ever sermon of over 500 mosques in the UK condemning grooming and standing up for victims. And as that narrative has been, and it's not that every person who's concerned about grooming is far right, because I'm certainly not far right, but Muslims stand on the side of victims. And for years and years, we've kind of like, because we've been talking about it, mosques have been talking about it, doing these sermons in the early 2010s, before the Robinsons of the world, before all of these people, you've got to call a spade and say, okay, there is no Muslim who's not saying that there is a model of grooming, which is where Pakistani men are overrepresented. Nobody's saying that. What we are saying, though, we have to address child sexual exploitation, and that's one form of child sexual exploitation out of three. So we're having an inquiry, and rightfully so. We should absolutely root this out. But Muslims stand, we are proud British Muslims. I'm a patriot. You know, I am, and we're having this conversation in the last few days, is that, you know, I grew up with a picture of a queen in my living room. I know lots of Pakistanis in Bradford did, you know, so what it means is, for us, is that we are being otherized, despite us being very confidently British.
Right, but I do want to bring you back to democracy is at stake. Populism is on the rise. And as an elected member of the government here, what does that mean about who we elect, and what does it mean to be electable? How do you get to that platform?
I think how we get
and
there...
And save democracy.
How we get there is we need braver conversations with people. We need to be brave in terms of... society has been changing, and we haven't been able to... I think not just successive governments. When I look at when I came into politics, we've lost the conversation around immigration. You know, I said that as part of my Labour interview when I was being interviewed to actually become a Labour candidate back in 2014. And I remember having that conversation. I think we've lost the narrative of what immigration brings to the country. And we need to claim that space back. And that takes bravery. And do we have... It was brilliant. The Literature Festival opening dinner, Sir Ben Okri did a speech, and he did a monologue about what's needed in politics. And what it needs is people to lead with light and not darkness. What it needs is courage, and it needs conviction. Do I think we have? At the moment, we seem to be, you know, Farage is taking up the narrative. Are we responding or are we leading? And I'm talking about us as a country. Mm. And there's a role for the electorate to play. There's a role for the politicians, but there's also a role for communities to play, because communities are very, very important. Because, you know, one of the strengths of a literature festival, and this is very different to any of a literature festival, this festival is rooted in community. And Bradford's community is absolutely amazing. And that's across Great Britain. So I think there's lots of work to be done about unpicking the narrative of the far right, but owning it with conviction and not... because what politicians, and I say this of politicians of all colours, they look at Twitter sphere, and the comments that are made, and then it shrinks people because you get a barrage of abuse. I know that because I've done it. I've won a libel case on being called a grooming gangs apologist. But you shrink because you get that much abuse, and you get that much, it's horrible. So we've got to just be braver in terms of confronting this threat to our democracy, because it is an absolute threat to our democracy.
So that's on the political stage. I'd like to turn, Isham, if I could turn to you in terms of, you know, national security and international policy. When you start looking at these international actors, outside actors that are taking advantage of the instability that is created on the political platform, can you speak a little to what impact that has on, you know, national security and international policy? And I'm just looking at your title, and I'm hoping that that's where this conversation leads, that we go from the academic to the political to international security.
Thank you, Nabila. And it's a pleasure, of course, to be in Bradford. It's my third event here today, and I'm really enjoying the Literature Festival. I wish somebody would have AC in this room, but apart from that, it's going really well. I have to confess, I'm not Mikdad Versi, as you've learned already. I think they saw the name Hellier and thought they should have a token white guy on stage, and they got it wrong, obviously. But it's a pleasure to be here. You know, we're at the end of June 2025, and in about a week, it will be the 20th anniversary of the 7th of July bombings. And I remember 7/7 really well. And I remember what happened not only on the day, but the repercussions of that day on our body politic, not simply in the UK, but across the continent as well. And there's a funny story that I'm reminded of because I'm sitting on a stage. 2 weeks after 7/7, some of you might remember, there were reports that there would be another attack, right? 2 weeks later. So I arrived in London on that day. I was living in Warwick at the time. And I remember arriving, I think it was at Euston, and having to walk from Euston to Chatham House to do a talk because everything was shut down. There were fears that there would be an attack on that day. And I thankfully got there in time and I did my talk. And there was a young man in the back who stood up and started spewing all sorts of stuff about how Muslim communities in this country were the problem and that we had to be careful about them and so on. And I remember thinking, I'm just going to wait for this guy to finish and then I'm going to wait for my turn to speak and then I'll try to address it as constructively as possible. And by the time I got around to doing it, he'd left, which was only about sort of 2 or 3 minutes later. And I had no idea who this guy was. And I thought, you know, this is really strange. He just came in to be an agent provocateur and then leave. His name was Douglas Murray. And I remember at the time someone saying, oh God, Dougie's at it again. And the number of times I've heard that expression since then is quite extraordinary. But it's very telling because, of course, he's playing and he was playing and many have played on a legitimate concern, i.e. our security, right? And then using that to push a certain agenda that is deeply politicized, is bereft of any sort of data. It's just purely about feeling. So now, as you mentioned, the MP, she hasn't even seen a niqab in her constituency probably, but she's decided to make this into the platform that she stands on. And the number of times over the past 20 years that I've seen very similar things, whether you're talking about the minarets ban in Switzerland, whether you're talking about the banning of the niqab, but also the hijab in many different public spaces across the continent, the rise of MAGA within the Republican Party in the United States, which is also where I work. I work at a think tank in London, but also in Washington, D.C., and so on and so on and so on. And when I think about this, you know, this intervening period of 20 years, and I consider your question, I think that the fundamental change from 2005 to 2025 is that the mainstreaming of the concerns and solutions that the far right raises and puts forward has been total. It's been total. It's no longer something that's marginal. It's no longer something that's on the quote-unquote extremes, if we mean, you know, far away from the center. On the contrary, they've brought all of that into the center. It's not even just on the right, it's also within even parts of the center left, okay? Because the response of the mainstream, including on issues of national security, has been to try to, you know, grab ground from the far right by sounding more like them. And the thing is that if you keep on trying to sound more like this other thing, but everybody knows you're faking it, they're just going to go for the original. Mm-hmm. Okay, why would I go for a cheap Rolex when I can get the real McCoy? Okay, and that's really what I think we've seen across the continent, in the United States and in the UK. And unfortunately, people just don't get it. They keep on doing the same mistake again and again and again. And when it comes to issues of national security, this is domestically, and then I'll touch on what you asked about externally. Domestically, it means that, again, genuine concerns, legitimate concerns, because we all want to live in security, get played on in order to push really destructive agendas. On the external part of it, I think that you also have to keep in mind that there are many forces that are outside of the UK, outside of Europe more generally, that would love to see nothing more than civil strife erupt all across the UK, but also more widely in Europe and the West. This is real. It's not a conspiracy. There's lots of documentation about it. The FISA might have even published a couple of things on this. And primarily, I have to say, it does come from the Russians. Okay, and I'm kind of loath to say that because it sounds as though it's like, oh no, Soviet Union stuff all over again. But it's real. And you see this when it comes to the Balkans in Bosnia, with the supporting of Serbian separatists. You see this in the UK. You see this with the support given to far-right parties across Europe, whether it's in Germany, whether it's in France and elsewhere. I don't think that it played the biggest role when it came to the American election, unlike some people, but it would be really silly to think that there was an interest in that regard. And the final thing that I'll say is that it is a transnational set of relationships, but it also plays into very wide spectrum of policy issues as well. And you see this when it comes to, for example, the issue of Israel-Palestine, Syria, Ukraine. It's not simply about what's at home. Okay, that's the world in which we live now. So, you know, 7/7/2005, I thought it was a very complicated world. It's far more complicated today.
Mm-hmm. So, Nafis, I want to pick up and really expand the way you did in your book, this notion of the mainstreaming of the far-right rhetoric. How did they do it? How far have they gone? If we listen to Hisham, they totaled it. How did they manage to infiltrate so deep? And what's the next step? How do we step it back?
So many questions in one.
I know. Listen. This is the. I want to turn it over to the audience. They're all going to be firing the same questions back.
So no, they're really good questions.
Lay the groundwork for us.
No, thank you so much, and thank you guys. You've really set the groundwork for the issues in the book. So, just to bring it all together, I think some of the stuff that we've spoken about and answer the question. I think what's extraordinary about what's going on, and actually this is really not understood. Actually, I really want to be clear that what I'm actually going to spell out here is actually just not understood at all in the mainstream. We're dealing with a process of radicalization that has taken a century and is now at an inflection point. I come at this from a systems theory point of view. I'm a systems theorist, and I understand how systems change and how they can flip. What's happened is that what was once a fringe ideology, groups of people around that have attempted quite deliberately to launder that fringe ideology into the mainstream. What I've done is I've traced some of the key organizations, institutions that they did this through, and how they began to actually impact very big mainstream names. And they did this through a process of funding, setting up organizations. A lot of this was done through philanthropy. A lot of these people are now household names. I mean, Douglas Murray is just one. He's a household name. He's very well known. He writes for The Spectator, writes for The Telegraph. He's on TV a lot. He's often wearing also kind of a press bulletproof thing outside the Gaza Strip and talking about the bombing campaign there and justifying it and all sorts of crazy things. So my story begins, ironically, back in 1937. There was a foundation that was set up called the Pioneer Fund. And it was set up by an American, his name was Wycliffe Draper. He was a textiles magnate. He made loads of money, and he also was a Nazi, loved the Nazis. So his foundation, the Pioneer Fund, actually had direct ties with Nazi Germany, had ties with eugenicists in Nazi Germany at the time. And there was a lot of cross-communication between them. Now, the reason this is really important is because this bizarre relationship literally set the tone for what would come all the way until today. And many of the same characters involved are also active today. So what happened at that time is you had this kind of incestuous relationship where the Americans were super inspired by things that they were hearing that the Nazis were saying. And then the Nazis were looking at what the Americans were doing. And they were saying, well, isn't that brilliant? You're talking about sterilization laws against black people and all this kind of stuff. Well, we should do that on an industrial scale in Germany. And so it became this kind of vicious circle. But of course, as I mentioned, you know, the change of world order also changed the dynamics of that. I want to fast forward now to what happened around the 1960s. So in the 60s, you can imagine, wasn't fashionable to be a card-carrying Nazi. So what were these guys doing? So a couple of really interesting things happened. One of them was that the Heritage Foundation, which is a major Washington, D.C. think tank, which is very active today, you may know them better in relation to something called Project 2025. Project 2025 was a blueprint for a Trump term, if he returned, that was being explored during the Biden era. And it was 1,000 pages of extensive planning and policy, and there were loads of different conservative organizations involved in it. But the Heritage Foundation, you go back to around that time, 60s and 70s, and right then, early on, there was a character called Edwin Fuellner, who was a co-founder, senior director. He recruited a Nazi called Roger Pearson into the Heritage Foundation, Roger Pearson was a major grantee of the Pioneer Fund. He was a white supremacist, he was an eugenicist, and he was an editor of the Pioneer Fund's main journal, Mankind Quarterly. And they published loads of stuff about scientific racism and the idea that there are these fundamental biological differences between human beings that manifest particularly in intelligence differences. And that in turn explains all of the hierarchies in society. Now, the reason this is important, and I'm going to fast forward again, is that this little weird nexus of extremists that had now begun to penetrate mainstream policy, mainstream conservative policy thinking, they continue to influence mainstream institutions. So just to give you an example of this, and I'm going to name another character here in this story who's very important. Who's heard of Charles Murray? There's some of you guys heard of Charles Murray. Charles Murray, distinguished Harvard-educated social scientist. So we fast forward to around the 1990s. He wrote a famous book. He wrote a number of books, but this is the kind of landmark book called The Bell Curve. Now, The Bell Curve was kind of like the Bible of scientific racism. He wrote this book, and it was based entirely almost on research that had been funded by the Pioneer Fund, same Nazi foundation set up in the 1930s. So he took all this research, he repackaged it, and he wrote this book. And this book was huge. It made a huge mainstream splash. It sparked a massive debate that made headlines across the world, not just in America. But what was really weird is that Charles Murray, in the ensuing years after 96, when he first published that book, he was flown over to the UK by Rupert Murdoch. And, you know, he landed on our shores and he had lots of meetings with a particular think tank that some of you might be familiar with, the Institute of Economic Affairs, which is a very well-known hard Brexit think tank that insisted that we need to crash out of the European Union without any sort of meaningful negotiation. This was a very famous, obviously, Thatcherite think tank. Now, during his travels and his time in London, he wrote a number of papers with the Institute of Economic Affairs about welfare reform. He created this concept of the British underclass, which was a very racialized concept, talked about the problems of the underclass and how the underclass is a self-perpetuating problem that needs to be dealt with, not by welfare reform, but essentially by containing the population. No point spending on these things. And you can begin to see where these kind of conservative ideas about don't spend on the poor, don't spend on minorities, don't spend on people who need it. In fact, don't spend. Just focus on the rich who are already rich and the well-to-do who are already well-to-do and the clever who are already clever. You can begin to see that this was a eugenics ideology already at play, behind, underlying some of these market-oriented ideas. Charles Murray then went and wrote articles in the Sunday Times about this stuff. But he was very careful. He didn't talk about the bell curve when he came to the UK. He knew that it wouldn't really land here. But nevertheless, he had a platform. And it continued from there. So one of the other extraordinary things that I discovered is that so many leading lights in the conservative movement in both the United States and the UK were inspired and read Charles Murray's work. And it's absolutely astonishing. So you mentioned Douglas Murray, Hisham. Douglas Murray quoted Charles Murray's book very early on in his career. He wrote a book called The Madness of Crowd, Madness of Crowds, which is over a decade ago. And in that book, he quotes Charles Murray and quotes the bell curve and talks about it as a really fascinating piece of work. And he's not the only one. A number of other leading lights, another guy, Matthew Goodwin, who is a very well-known kind of lightning rod in the academic circuit here on the right wing. He's worked with institutions which are like the Legatum Institute, several others. He has also referenced material that traces back to some of these ideas and has also many other ties, even like Toby Young, who heads up the Free Speech Union here, which is one of the biggest kind of, I would call them shock jock advocacy organizations, which attempts to use free speech as a way to actually justify and legitimize racism, anti-Muslim speech, and all sorts of kind of crazy things. The Free Speech Union, Toby Young, actually is an open eugenicist. He's openly talked about his belief in Charles Murray's work, and he believes that people who criticize Charles Murray's work are trying to somehow combat free speech. So that's all of that. That's kind of like the groundswell. I think where it gets really scary, and I'm sorry to go on, but I want to kind of close on this last part, which is we're looking at people like Elon Musk now standing on the stage and doing back-to-back Nazi salutes. And the entire press is kind of looking at it, not really wanting to call it out for what it is. I mean, we can all bloody see what it is. It's back-to-back Nazi salutes. How is that happening? So ironically, I also found that people in Silicon Valley, like Peter Thiel, like Elon Musk, like Mark Anderson, and many of these other big shots, David Sachs, all of these guys, the PayPal mafia, some people call them, because they all kind of were kind of interconnected. They're all kind of pro-Trump. They're all putting money into his campaign. All of them were inspired by the same ideology, every single one. So Elon Musk, for instance, he was has recommended work and funded work by an Oxford philosopher called Nick Bostrom. Nick Bostrom articulates a number of kind of very strange techno-utopian ideas that have become very, very prominent in Silicon Valley. The ideas of kind of human beings were merging with machines and all this kind of stuff. Yet he also is an ardent supporter of eugenicist ideas and has referred to these ideas around the bell curve. So I became really surprised when I realized that Charles Murray's ideas have actually penetrated the heart of mainstream conservative thinking. And this is kind of the elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about. And what it means is that underlying some of these ideas is a very, very dangerous ideology. And it's led us to a point where we have very, very key figures. One of them is another character called Curtis Yarvin, who I've mentioned in the book and described him. He's influenced people like Peter Thiel. He's influenced people like Elon Musk. He was turned up at the Trump inauguration. He's a kind of tech bro kind of blogger. And he has actually advocated the end of democracy as the solution to all of the problems. And how did he end up with that idea? You can see the logic when he says, well, if we actually genuinely believe that the problem is inferior groups of people that are genetically just not all there, then democracy is actually the problem, because democracy is what allows the masses, the untamed masses, to kind of take control of politics and do crazy things. And we can't allow that. We need to have the clever cognitive elite in charge of things. So actually, the biggest threat to humanity is democracy. So we actually need to actually overthrow democracy. And what do we replace democracy with? But we should replace it with the rule of the corporation, which is run by the talented billionaire white guy. So what we should have actually is, forget nation states, forget sovereignty, forget national borders and democratic control. We should have a patchwork of corporate controlled entities where residents don't have any real say in the rule of law, and the law is made by the sovereign individual. And that ideology was echoed across the pond by British authors, including the father of Jacob Rees-Mogg, William Rees-Mogg. And obviously, Jacob Rees-Mogg is very influential in the kind of the radical side of the Conservative Party, as well as some parts of the investment community here in the city. So you can begin to see how insidious this ideology is and how deeply it's penetrated kind of the subterranean levels of the right wing on all sides of the Atlantic.
So it's pretty bleak, is what you're saying.
Yep.
That's a summary of what you're saying, right?
It's bleak. Pretty big.
It's pretty bleak. So I'm going to ask the same question to both the other two speakers. And it's going to be one question. I'm not going to make it a compound question, because you've all said that I'm going to keep asking compound questions. What's the pushback? I'm going to start with Hisham from a security and policy perspective, and then I'm going to come back to you, Naz, and saying be brave isn't enough. Concrete pushback. What should we be doing to push back? And then I want to turn it over to the audience.
Are you asking me what the pushback should be?
What it should be. I don't think it is. I'm not going to give my view. What should it be? give us your view. What should it be?
So I think that there has been some pushback.
Okay.
It's not remotely sufficient because I don't think people understand the scale of the problem, mm-hmm. and they tackle it in a very piecemeal kind of way. So, for instance, within the national security establishment, you have many people who correctly identify that the greatest growing threat in terms of radicalization and extremism actually comes from the far right. That's the data. It's not an ideological point. It's the data. But I don't think that they realize how far that goes. And also, they're talking about people being pulled into groups, into actual far right groups. And my point, and I think, you know, Nafis echoes this in his work, is that it goes beyond the groups. It's actually tremendously impacted the way the mainstream considers these issues and has moved the needle a lot on those issues within the mainstream to the point where you actually don't need the far right for many of these mm-hmm. things anymore right. because you've got others who are taking it up. So I think there needs to be a bigger awareness of how far that has spread. I think also, again, another quote-unquote anniversary that's happening right around now, and we're doing an event tomorrow on this, Srebrenica, the Bosnian genocide, 1995, 30 years ago. We like to think we're really far away from that happening on the continent. We're not.
No.
We're not at all. And it's very concerning in that regard, because the level of anti-Muslim bigotry in particular, okay, there is anti-Semitism, of course, as well, but the level of anti-Muslim sentiment, bigotry, rhetoric that has been allowed to be mainstreamed across the continent, okay? And I will say, and I don't know if this will surprise anybody, but of course there are layers to this. The most bigotry is reserved for a Palestinian Muslim. In a headscarf. And then it goes from there. Okay. And seeing, especially over the past 2 years, the sort of rhetoric around Muslims, Arabs, Palestinians in particular, to the point where the president of the United States of America, the most powerful nation in the world, uses the word Palestinian as an insult, mm-hmm. as a smear. Yep. Okay. In describing Chuck Schumer, mm-hmm. right? And saying, oh, he's basically a Palestinian now, mm-hmm. as an insult. Yeah. I don't think people realize quite what that means. And it leads to death. It leads to murder. It did in the United States. Of course, it has done tremendously so within the Israeli context. And this is something that we haven't brought up. And I don't want to bring it up too much because I think that we're probably covering this a lot in other places. But there is a direct line that goes from the far right in Europe and the United States to emboldening people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich in the Israeli government, even while this lot know that anti-Semitism is rife here and that these are literally the intellectual political descendants of the Nazis, even so, mm-hmm. right? So having that awareness that these things are indeed interconnected, that they are very, very broadly, you know, that the levels of which this has impacted our national politic and our discussion media wise, but and of course within the political arena, if you don't open yourself up to the recognition that this is actually incredibly wide, then it just means it gets much and much worse.
It gets worse.
And you have people just looking for ways to sort of get away and go somewhere else. And that's not the answer.
Niles, I'm going to have you hold for a second because I want to make sure that people in the audience get a chance to ask a question. And if not, then I'll come back to you with any questions from the audience.
My comment is actually to you, Niles. And I say this as a woman of color to another woman of color with respect and love, because I can't imagine what you must have been through in the position that you hold. But this whole discussion is really, really triggering. And I have to speak the truth here. The Labour Party, of which you are a member, their silence is absolutely deafening. On state violence, their failure to call out the dehumanising of refugees, their support for authoritarian policing bills and their embrace of border nationalism, punitive welfare narratives, and the racialized surveillance of communities. These are emboldening the far right, and they're repackaged by Labour under the banner of security. I feel that Labour have tried to reclaim their so-called patriotic ground, and they've adopted this language of the oppressor, demonising protests, pandering to racist press, and abandoning their historic role as a voice for the marginalised. When Labour fails to speak up against war crimes in Gaza and it punishes MPs,
so I think
it really sends a chilling message.
There were a lot of questions.
I'll just end with this, complicity...
I'm going to tell them to cut the mic.
Okay.
I'm sorry. There were a lot of other people in the audience asking questions.
Can we have an answer to that question, though, please?
I didn't hear the actual question.
We will be around for discussion afterwards, but there are literally 10 questions. Unless, Naz, you'd like to address it.
No, I'm happy. So it's actually, had you asked me the question of what we should do, that would have answered some of those things in advance of the actual question. So I value the question, because the truth is that if we don't lead with conviction, we do leave that void. And right now, the welfare bill, I'm a signatory to that amendment, which was being pulled, and then we're considering another amendment, which is potentially for Monday. So I'm in the same space in terms of welfare rights. I'm in the same space. Look, I'm a person, like you said, I'm a woman of colour. I feel it. I've worked on the Palestinian issue for the last 10 years since I've been in politics. I get it. I've worked around Islamophobia for 10 years. You know, I'm one of the highest risk MPs in the region because of a threat from the far right. So I get it. And I also get that when we make policies, they have an impact, and that's how communities feel. I also know that the Labour Party have got a long hill to get up to rebuild that trust with its working class communities and Muslims. So I'm in that space. What I can say is that the challenge of leadership is to be part of that conversation and be inside that party. So because if I leave, then that leaves a voice. If everybody who has an issue or they want to change the narrative in the Labour Party, it's like over this last weekend, the amount of work that has gone on in the last few days, even this morning, even yesterday, around the welfare rights bill, we have made moves. Are they moves enough? I'm not convinced they are. But again, it's something I'm going to sit down and go through word by word tomorrow. There are lots of things that are happening at the moment that I'm really, really uncomfortable with. But I equally know that if I vacate that space, I leave a void. I'm not prepared to do that because it's harder to be on the inside to try and make change. But I give you my word that I will continue to be an advocate for those voiceless and working class, because by anybody's standards, I am the most working class MP in Parliament. So I'm not about to abdicate that responsibility. And at times, politics is about making the case. And that's not always, to me, and I said this in the chamber only 2 weeks ago when we were doing the assisted dying bill, it's not about, for me, it's beyond activism. Everybody in Parliament is an activist because they have something at the core of them that they want to change. But then we have to behave in a way where we have the foresight, but our electorate puts their trust in me to make sure that I'm making decisions which are long-term effective. And sometimes it's about choosing which hill you're prepared to die on, mm-hmm. because is it going to be, you know, we've had this conversation many a times on Palestine, on welfare rights, on lots and lots of things. So that's the only reassurance I can give you, that I will play my part. One person out of 400 something MPs, you know, we're working. There are people in there. And that I would ask you to encourage and support your MPs and write to your MP and lobby your MP, including me, you know, because the more you lobby, the more you will influence. This is about you. You are an electorate. This is, you know, the whole point of this conversation is saving democracy, is so that your voices can have an impact. You know, so that I need your support for that as well. So if you're my constituent, please write to me.
Naz, thank you for addressing that question. And I do apologise for cutting the mic. Yes. Right over here. Yep.
Hi. Sorry, I've almost forgotten my question now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can I just add a word to this? And that's misogyny, which is absolutely rife on the far right. One of my particular interests is always, where are those small levers that those those of us as individuals can start pushing. And very conscious that women are not a minority in this country, and that a lot of the things that the right talks about are very anti-women. So do we specifically have a role as women in all this?
Yeah. And actually, let's take a couple more questions and then the panelists will address them individually. Yep.
My question is built upon, it's more of a quick overview. I work in a warehouse. I came from education. I never, ever say that I went to university, et cetera, because I'd be the odd person out. We do have discussions about immigration and things like that. At first, what I found was they just scream back at me. I say, why are you shouting at me? I'm just, you know, stood next to you. What I'm trying to say is that even when you come out with the most sensible, rational argument backed up by facts and figures, it just doesn't seem to resonate. However, what I have found, and it's difficult to do, the more you build up a trust in those people, and they'll come and see you by themselves. I didn't want to ask you this question in front of everybody, but could we have a discussion about X, Y, and Z? When I go back into the warehouse, I'm going to proudly say, you're right, the hospital was full of immigrants, and they were the people who were helping me to get better. And I'm very pleased that I can, you know, use that as a really good story to relate to them.
Connect. And then back there.
How much has the arrogance, the out-of-touchness, and sometimes the sheer lunacy of the left fed the far right? I have in mind the following brief examples. One, the shenanigans over pretending Biden wasn't senile, and then you had Kamala Harris thrust on top of the people. That was the state. In this country, you've had lunacy like a sex offender being thrust into a woman's prison. You've also had people like myself who've spent 30 years being a private tutor to the Asian community in Bradford, which was a great privilege, made very nice curries, by the way, being called a white patriarchal racist because I didn't agree with a white left-wing woman about something she said about the royal family. So to some degree, I agree with what you say about the right, but I can't help thinking that the arrogance of the left has, to some degree, made them the authors of their own misfortune.
Thank you for your comment. I think there's a question right up front as well, right here.
Hi, I'm not sure I'm going to articulate it very well, but I've read a lot about India and the British Empire and India, the East India Company, and I hear always so many resonances talking about the far right that just go straight back to the exact same language that I was hearing read about in Empire. And I think too little focus or consideration is given to the extent to which the having of Empire and the losing of Empire, especially the having of Empire, fundamentally shaped the way that Britain is structured, the way that you have an elite that is oppressive over a huge majority, celebration of militarism, violence, hierarchy. And I think it still massively permeates the elite culture, and also to some extent the acceptance of an elitism amongst the bulk of people. But it's never, ever given consideration. And it's so recent, you know. And I think when I was born in 1968, the Empire felt like a million miles away. And I realize now that it was literally just around the corner. And yet, while we talk endlessly about our victories in the Second World War, we just parked the Empire, and there's no discussion about. And when we do, it's like, was it a good thing or a bad thing for the colonies? But what about, was it a good thing or a bad thing for Britain and the way that it's structured and the way that we have still this unthinking elitism and hierarchy and Islamophobia goes straight back. I mean, it's right back to the first Anglo-Afghan war, and there's so much that is just, I don't know, I feel like it's utterly entrenched and we don't talk about it.
So if I can kind of put them into buckets, there's a bucket of, you know, sort of like trust and relatability, you know, going and, you know, meeting with individuals on a one-on-one basis and being relatable. I think there is an issue of, and both the first question and a couple of the questions back there around how much are we on the left responsible for, you know, turning a blind eye to what was going on? And then over here, I guess it's more in terms of, you know, sort of the history of empire building and what it has left us with in terms of, you know, how we're going to move forward, when actually I don't think that there is an opportunity for us to build empires going forward, but we've got that legacy still in the back of our mind as to how we operate. And I'm just going to throw it open to all three of you. Whichever one of you wants to jump in, go right ahead. Oh, and there was a question. Yes, and there was a comment on, and Naz, maybe you'll end up addressing that or relating to, you know, sort of the underlying issues of, you know, misogyny that permeate right across the board. So whoever wants to jump in.
So let me try and bring it together a bit. These are all really brilliant questions, by the way. Thank you so much. I'll start with the misogyny and we'll go from there. So that's a really important point, because what this really comes back to is that this is not just about minorities. It's about all of us. This is an agenda that tries to persuade us that there is a bunch of people that you don't really know about that are really problematic. And that's the problem in your society. Deal with them and you'll solve everything. Always, always, always question when someone oversimplifies. That's what I'd suggest to you. When politicians oversimplify with that kind of rhetoric, you just have to think, wait a minute, is that really true? Is it really true that what is right in front of my face is the thing that I need to be afraid of? Usually it isn't. Usually the politicians are being a little bit clever and self-serving about that. And it's not just the politicians, it's industry, it's lobbies and all the rest of it. I think so it's really important to mention that women are on the front lines of that crisis, because we can see that in the United States quite bluntly with the very, very extreme approach to anti-abortion, the way in which that's now impacting rhetoric here, the way in which Nigel Farage has leapt on that rhetoric, which he wouldn't have done and never did years ago. Suddenly it's an important issue for him. Why? Why is it important for you now, Nigel? You've never spoken about this before in your life. Mm-hmm. And now today it's so important. Does it have something to do with the fact that you might get some funding from the United States? Maybe it has something to do with it. The fact that maybe you guys are incestuously connected. So I think we need to ensure that we are critically aware of these things. That also applies to Labour. I think those are really legitimate questions about the left and Labour. But to bring it back, I want to, and to answer that, to come back to that question, I want to circle back to this bigger issue. And I think the gentleman at the back mentioned a really interesting thing about, you know, people, you know, don't understand, you know, they believe these things about the problems of migrants and all this stuff. So let me just take it back. And the book actually does address this in some depth. But I want to take it back to one simple idea. And if you don't get the book and whatever, that's fine. But and that's why I want to leave you with this, which is that we're dealing with a big systemic civilizational crisis right now. Climate change is just the one end symptom of that. It's all about our relationship to the earth. One of the metrics by which we measure this is our use of energy. There's a metric that's really, really important. No one talks about it, but it's called energy return on investment, EROI. It measures the amount of energy that you use to get a certain amount of energy out. And that sounds really abstract and weird, but it's very simple. When you're looking at our global fossil fuel system, you can measure the amount of energy we use to get the energy, useful energy out. And what we've found is that since the 1960s, we used to use a little bit of energy to get tons out. And now that's changed. In fact, the EOI level has hemorrhaged by about half. So now we're using way more energy to get less energy out. And that is a slow burn crisis that has impacted the entire economic system. And economists, mainstream economists, free market economists don't understand this crisis because they don't think the economy has any relationship to the environment or to energy. They don't have those metrics factored in. So they're looking at this stuff. They didn't anticipate the 2008 financial crash. I predicted it actually 6 months in advance. And 2 years before, I was talking about the danger of financial crash. So I was tracking these trends. And the reason I mention this is because I've been looking at this stuff. And it was 15 years ago that I was looking at the inflection point between EROI, cost of living, the impact on communities. And I made a prediction. I said, if nothing is done about these crises, then the heartlands, the mainstream heartlands of liberal democracy are going to be subverted by the far right, and the far right will take the mainstream. And when I made that prediction, I didn't expect it to be that spot on, but it's happening right now. It's happening right now. What does that tell us about the what we need to learn about this situation? It tells us that when we're talking about the movement of people, they're coming into our communities, what is actually the issue of why is it that cost of living is so difficult? Why is it that there's not enough money to spend? Why is there persistent austerity? Why is the education system falling apart? Why is the healthcare system falling apart? It's not because of migrants. And it's like the gentleman said, when you look at the data and we look at actually what's the contribution of migrants economically, how does it actually work? You know,
so she's grabbing her.
So I want to bring the question back to, you know, the hubris of the left to shut its, has it shut its eyes? So maybe I'm going to turn it over to Hisham, because I know, like, you've laid the groundwork for what has happened, but are we ignoring our own role on the left? Have we ignored our role in the United States? I will agree with the gentleman at the back. It was utter hubris to put up Biden and to not even give Kamala the opportunity to build a campaign. But we can talk about that at the back, and I'm happy to talk about that at the back later. But let's talk about the hubris of the left in ignoring its role in allowing things to get as out of hand as they have gotten. Hisham, would you like to pick that up?
I would love to talk about it, but I just heard the bells go chime. And I see Simon in the back. We've got five minutes? Okay, I will do this in two, because I think that we should hear from Naz. I just want to say one thing on that labor question. As somebody who's not a labor member, has never been a member of any political party in this country on a matter of principle because of the work that I do. Going into government departments on issues that I think you also care about, judging from your t-shirt, which I applaud you for, the discussions that I'm able to have today are far less challenging than they were under the last government. They're not good enough remotely at all, but the conversations can actually be had in a way that they couldn't be had before. So I think you make very good points. I think that that's been recognized. I hope you also appreciate that you have the chance to make those arguments within those rooms now in ways that simply weren't possible before. It's not enough. It's not enough in the slightest, okay? Just coming here. A new study came out, which Haaretz publicizes. We're talking more than 100,000 people dead in Gaza. 100,000 people, at least. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's not remotely enough, but you can have that discussion, which I think you should have full freedom to operate within. So that was just one thing I wanted to say about that. I won't mention anything more about the misogyny part, because I think Nafis covered that. In terms of the arrogance of the left, and again, because of the work that I do, I try not to be politically partisan as much as humanly possible. But on a very human level, if there are issues that people find important and you sweep them aside, okay, so people had concerns about multiculturalism, for example, okay, I didn't think those concerns were correct, but that doesn't matter. They hold those concerns and you can't simply sweep them to one side. My father, God rest his soul, was from not even a village. He lived out, he was brought up outside in the countryside near Crawley. In his lifetime, Leicester was a completely white city. Mm. It's not a white city anymore. And I'm not surprised that there will be people that will find that hard to process over time. And I don't think people should be embarrassed to talk about how they feel about that, but that we should do it in a way that recognizes that we all belong to this country. Mm-hmm. And when you put that stuff down, okay, and I think that this is true of the left, I think it's, how should we say, a genuine critique of the left, because they claim to want to try to bring everybody together. Actually, when you apply this to the right, it doesn't work very well, because actually they don't.
Yeah.
Okay, not in the same way. So I do think that raising concerns should be done, not sweeping them under the carpet, certainly not doing something as silly as what the gentleman suggested about just handing over to somebody that nobody knew, because of course it does open up the space for the far right to take over. I hope I did 2 minutes. And
you did. I would like to make one comment in response to that. That kind of question, it's possible here. The chilling effect in the United States, where I spend most of my time, that kind of question actually is dragged out of the room. So at least the left here has got some teeth. They may be baby teeth, but it is at least some teeth that allow that kind of question to be asked in a forum and responded to quite ably by Naz, I think. But Naz, please
I have lots of struggles, you know, as a politician, because I'm not a career politician. But one of the things that I've really, really come to learn, because I very much went as an activist, as a women's rights activist, is that here you have, and again, like Hisham says, there are conversations that are happening now that wouldn't have happened, because the 9 years I've been in opposition, I can promise you now, these conversations wouldn't have happened. You had a Tory government that was challenging the ICC. Mm-hmm. You've got a government now that is recognising the ICC. You've got a government that was there is a huge difference between what we had post the last election, what we have. Doesn't make it enough, but there is a massive difference. And I think we should take that, and we should want more, but we should definitely take that. And I also think that for the Prime Minister, for Starmer, when we were talking about recognition of Palestine, and that's just an example I'll use, is the week that we were going to, there was a conversation to potentially the pressure on from the backbenchers, including myself, for immediate recognition. It didn't happen because Israel struck Iran. But that conversation was happening, and the next day, when we had that, when it was leaked to The Guardian or whatever, the next day the submarine contract was reviewed. Mm-hmm. So we've got to be, as much as being right doesn't make us righteous. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what I've really, really learned. Just because I'm right and I'm passionate about it doesn't make me righteous, because if our economy, and this is how you address the far right, mm-hmm. because where does the far right get their hold? Because there's instability, because there's fear, because we don't have security, because we don't have jobs, we don't have that economic stability. And then if you're taking things, if you're doing what would make you righteous, then risks your economy and President Trump turning up the tariffs for us because he's pissed with the UK, effectively, then where does that, what did that righteousness get us when the community here is suffering because we've lost contracts? And they're worth billions and billions to our economy. They're worth hundreds of thousands of jobs. They're worth this. Those are the decisions I would not wish upon anybody. But those are decisions that have to be taken. And somebody's taking them. And sometimes it's above my pay grade to try and understand. I try and understand. And I try my best to understand. But I don't know. I'm not a Right Honourable. I'm not a Privy Councillor where I'm in those rooms where I can go out and say things which might not. There's lots of things that the cabinet will do that don't make sense to backbenchers, and we struggle with it, but then we don't necessarily know the information they always do as well. And that's hard, but that's the reality. So there's something about accepting all of that is at threat. The more insecurity that Britain has, the more we do, we cannot speak from strength. We have to have our strength first. And I'll be honest, the last 9 years that I spent in opposition, it was embarrassing what the Tories made our country. You know, we had 5 years, in those 9 years, 5 years was taken up with Brexit. After Brexit, we had COVID. Then we had Partygate. We weren't doing legislation. The nobility of politics, people started hating politicians. And why shouldn't they? When one rule applies to you, one rule applies to the others. And then there was scandal, the COVID contracts. It damaged us. And there is something about the next 5 years, 10 years even, of just gaining our reputation back as Great Britain. Now, I'm a trade envoy for Indonesia, and I went out, and you realise, wow, what damage the last nine years that I've been there, or 14 years under the Tories has been, what damage Brexit has done to us, what damage all of this has done to us. So I just try sometimes, and I'd encourage others to try and just, yes, you might be right, but does that make us righteous? And that's the thing I want to leave us with, because when we're righteous, then that if we're being righteous because we need to do it and we get it off our chest, mm-hmm. what next? Yeah. What next for our country as well? Yeah. And it's so, not easy.
Will you stand the left independent at the next general election?
No.
No.
Hell no, I ain't standing independent.
What do you say to your former colleagues who are now suspended?
I'm not part of a hard left. Let me make it really clear here. My politics are not hard left. My politics are very, very My politic, the reason I joined the Labour Party
okay, so we're gonna,
is because I believe in righteous, justice and fairness.
Nas, I'm going to use the same rule. Okay, I'm going to use the same rules here as I did over there, so I'm going to cut your mic.
Cool.
right? I am going to let Nafees wrap up, and please, if you can keep it to 1 minute and just wrap us up. And we will be around for the rest of the festival. For the rest of the festival at the end, yeah, okay.
Very quickly, 30 seconds. I think I wanted to just address the issue of the bankruptcy of the left where we stand today. Let's be really clear. Right now, the left as it stands, whether it's Labour or it's far left or whatever, no one is dealing with the big systemic crises that are driving the challenges that we actually have today. A lot of this is tinkering on the edge. Yes, I would say that this government is probably doing much more on, say, clean energy and many other issues which have not been done before, which is really good, really positive. But it's nowhere near enough. It's nowhere near enough. We do not have fundamental systemic change. Until we have a party and a government that deals with real systemic transformation of our lives, root and branch, we are going to be in this swing politics, swinging from left to right, going to ever more deeper fringes and extremes. And it's going to get messy and dangerous. So we need to educate ourselves about what's really at the root of these crises and spread that awareness as far and wide so that we have a civic population that can create real democracy. Democracy where we are all involved and engaged. And that means getting our hands dirty, guys. So let's do that. Let's create a new kind of democracy from the grassroots.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.